and welcome to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we're here on RBN Live, the Republic Broadcasting Network, every Wednesday from 8 a.m. In Anchorage time, it's 8 a.m., and Central time, we're 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., so we're here every week. Today, we're going to talk, just cover some of the stuff going on in the news. You know, we cover a lot of issues over the last few months on this program, dealing with technologies, dealing with oil issues, dealing with really the state of political affairs. And there's some interesting stories in today's news, a couple of AP stories. The first one, which is kind of interesting, it's again another story about Mavericks, and the headline reads, "First Time Hopeful Beats Two Others in Massachusetts." You know, there's primaries taking place around the country today, and many of these are resulting in upsets. We had some here in Alaska, a 20-year U.S. senator and four-year governor here just got defeated summarily in his primary over really corruption issues and the kinds of things that are making the news around the country in many, many regions of the country are those stories. You know, it started at the national level here in Alaska. I mentioned a few weeks ago, 20 legislative offices were raided by the FBI. In fact, unprecedented here in Alaska, investigating oil corruption. You know, there's been a lot going on with oil and gas in the country. This scandal brewing, you know, the last big oil scandal was Teapot Dome back in the late 1920s. It brought down a whole array of both local and national politicians in Wyoming where that scandal broke. But here in Alaska, one of the people who actually is being investigated, his offices were seized and records seized for by the FBI, was Ben Stevens, president of the Alaska Senate and son of Ted Stevens, one of the senior senators from Alaska, one of them getting a lot of notoriety for the bridges to nowhere and a number of other issues from time to time. But again, you know, here's this issue of corruption, misuse of funds. I mean, the thing that's going on here is the company being investigated is a oil and gas service company that's contributed over the last 10 years $570,000 to local elections. In the last election, $84,000 by just four executives. And, you know, in the old days, you know, contributions were a little recognized for what they were. We used to call it bribery. You know, what did it get you? It got you access. It got you outcomes. It got you an opportunity to talk to legislators. And that's exactly what these kinds of political contributions at these levels breed as well. You know, the average person can't even go into a legislative office, state or a national, and expect to spend more than 2 or 3 minutes, perhaps if that, with their legislative elected officials. And yet these guys who contribute thousands of dollars to campaigns not only get access, they influence a great deal of the legislation that passes. And, you know, here in Alaska, oil and gas issues affect the whole nation. And, you know, these are issues that aren't even making the mainstream media. But around the country, we're starting to see these kinds of reports. And, you know, sort of on the other side of the world, an article that grabbed me today was one that's headed Tape Ignites Riots in Streets. And it's an article, about from Budapest, Hungary, talking about their prime minister who admitted lying to obtain his goals of getting elected, all right? Now, lying for a politician, you know, kind of go hand in hand in most of the world. But in Hungary, they really take exception to it. And I think this is a really incredible statement. 10,000 people hit the streets in Budapest over the guy lying. And this is what they caught him saying. Just a little bit of it. I mean, there's 25 minutes of taped. But here's what the prime minister said, and I quote. He said his government lied morning, evening, and night. You know, he went on to say, we did nothing for 4 years, nothing. No European country has done something as boneheaded as we have. Plainly, we lied throughout this last year and the last year and a half and 2 years, the prime minister said. Hey, the music's coming up. We're going to get back after the break. But let's talk about what lying does for you in Hungary versus what it does for you in the United States. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time, right here on the Republic Broadcasting Network. You know, just going through the news this morning, you know, and looking at all of this, you know, and looking at what happens in Hungary, you know, Eastern Bloc countries were lied to for so long that they really, really take exception to it. I mean, the idea that a prime minister gets caught lying and people are calling, you know, for him to be sent to Siberia, literally, in the country. You know, that kind of public outcry, you know, what happens and what I've noted in Europe when I've traveled through Europe is because people know what it's like to be oppressed, I mean, overtly and openly, there's lots of resistance to anything that even smells of it, including the old propaganda machines of the past. And so you see this kind of reaction, you know, here in the United States, we just don't see it. We just don't see that kind of reaction. And yet this year we're starting to see a little bit of agitation out there in terms of the standard political fare. And I'm really pleased to see that around the country, people are looking at the Mavericks, the ones that stand out, the ones that stand for something, as those candidates to support. And I'm seeing them from both the conservative side and the liberal side on those main issues, and the issues of integrity. Those are becoming the overshadowing issues and should be this election season. You know, I want to cover some additional news on what's happening here. You know, the Vico scandal, the oil and gas scandal brewing here in Alaska may reach out and touch who knows who, because here in Alaska we have billions, literally billions of dollars at stake. Major oil tax concessions were had by these companies' lobbying efforts over the last session, significantly changing the equations up here. You know, last time we were on a couple weeks ago, we talked about British Petroleum and what they're doing in terms of trying to police themselves by hiring one of the strongest judges, retired judges, to bring judgments against the oil industry here in Alaska as an internal ombudsman, someone that people can go to report on issues with some level of confidentiality within the company. And, you know, this idea of whistleblowing within government is something that we're starting to hear a lot more about around the country. Here in my part of the world, there's quite a bit going on there. There's good laws on the books that allow people to move forward. And because of those laws, oil and gas issues are, in fact, the central theme to our governor's race, and it's over ethics in that industry at a time, even starting before the FBI started kicking down doors up here. You know, the other strange stuff in oil and gas news, people don't maybe see it over the AP wire services, but here in Alaska, we have a huge problem in rural Alaska. All of the energy virtually in rural Alaska is fed by diesel generating engines for electric power, but there's no roads. So oil is, heating oil is sent out, and it runs between $5 and $7 a gallon. In communities throughout Alaska, 168 rural communities that essentially have 40 to 45% unemployment levels. Now, that's unbelievable in most parts of the United States, but here in Alaska, that is, in fact, the case in rural parts of the state. What has happened in the last day and hitting our newspapers today in Anchorage was Venezuela, through their company's Citgo, C-I-T-G-O, which is based in Houston. The company's owned by the Venezuelans, and they are providing $5 million in fuel oil aid to rural Alaska. Now, get this. They're going to provide 100 gallons of heating oil for each household in 151 villages, worth about $5 million, bucks. And they're going to do that, I guess, beginning immediately. Now, get this. Here in Alaska, we're producing 20% of all the domestic oil consumption. I mean, we're producing tremendous amounts of oil and gas here. And our state legislature actually cut rural electrification assistance in the last couple of sessions of the legislature. And we have record high revenues from oil and gas. Same time, we gave the oil and gas industry here a $50 million tax incentive, tax savings in terms of local state taxes. Well, we cut rural subsidies for energy for people that are on fixed incomes, many of them Social Security, aged, or certainly chronically unemployed for lack of jobs in Bush, Alaska. And the Venezuelan government's stepping in, and this guy certainly isn't historically the friend of this country. He's meeting with Iran this last week, and every tyrant that opposes American policy for varieties of reasons. But it is interesting to see this in our local paper, and I'm sure that hasn't made it around the national news just yet, but perhaps it will today. You know, that idea of oil and gas here in Alaska, another piece of news in our papers, the Red Dog zinc mine, lead and zinc mine in northwestern Alaska, the biggest one, incidentally, in the United States, is going to be tapping local natural gas, a natural gas field owned by native corporations and the state. They're tapping natural gas there as the fuel supply to avoid the diesel in that particular mine. You know, these resources throughout Alaska are huge. Natural gas alone could provide domestic energy. Coal, known reserves in Alaska, cover 2,000 years of energy. And Venezuela's providing aid to Alaskan villages for energy resources. Something is definitely upside down here. Fortunately, the right people are taking a look at it. Maybe we'll see the right indictments and some people go to jail where they belong. And we get a little bit more of our Democratic Republic back, not just here, but around the country. Get involved in the political races in your communities. You know, make sure you're putting a little bit of time in for those guys that are doing good work. You know, my family's been involved in politics in my region of the world for now over 50 years. My dad was in the state Senate. He was in the United States Congress. My brother Mark is currently mayor of Anchorage, which is half of our state's population. And I know one thing, you can still, and I think we can see that around at least at the local level, still make a huge difference. And hopefully people are not giving up on that. You know, today's call-in number two to get involved in the conversation is 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. You know, going back to the news of the day, here's one that broke a little bit earlier this month, September 12th. And many have talked about this already around talk networks, but it's the Air Force Chief. It was Secretary of the Air Force Michael Wine, who made the statement that we ought to be testing our non-lethal weapons on U.S. civilians before being used on the battlefield. I mean, this is a CNN report from September 12, 2006 on the Washington AP wires, you know, talking about using things like high-powered microwaves. And here's what it says. Non-lethal weapons such as high-powered microwave devices should be used on American citizens in crowd control situations before using them in the battlefield, the Air Force Secretary said Tuesday. Now, that's something we actually talked about in a book I wrote with Gene Manning called Angels Don't Play This Harp. And we wrote it back in 1994-95, and we had uncovered a joint protocol back then between the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of Defense, where all priority funding for non-lethal weapons went to dual use, those that could be used both against our own citizens domestically and against our declared enemies. And when you see this statement, the Air Force, this is not something new. This is 11-year-old joint policy agreements signed off between Department of Justice and DOD in 1994-95. And, you know, when we start to look at this idea of domestic testing, and the device they're talking about is the one that we keep seeing repeated as if it's some new news story, and it's this microwave dish on a Humvee, and it's supposed to create heating sensations on the surface of the skin equal to about 130 degrees. Now, that's kind of interesting, but they don't really tell you the whole story. Firstly, we got to look at heating the skin to 130 degrees. You know, this the last time we decided burning was appropriate for behavior modification, we were still burning people in Salem. And we kind of gave that idea up as, you know, maybe not the right practice to engage in a civil society. But this device has much more capability. If you change the pulse rate, waveform, or frequency, or any number of other parameters on this microwave broadcasting system, you can affect any of the vital organs of the body, according to the Air Force's own research that they actually contracted with the University of Utah back in 1984 and 85, and they published the Radio Frequency Dosimetry Handbook. And it's the dosages of microwave energy, the stuff that's produced in this dish, for affecting all the vital organs of the body, the liver, the lungs, the heart. And this is a technology that they don't talk about as they introduce so-called non-lethal weapons into the battlefield environment. You know, the idea that the Air Force is even moving forward pretty dramatically in not just the non-lethal areas, but there's reasons for that. You know, the CNN factor, that's what the military calls it. It's the news factor. It's talk radio factor. It's any time that we can discuss something because at least we get the theoretical free press that provides us at least some images as to what's going on around the world. The idea of getting rid of some of the darker images so you can't see the carnage quite so graphically might make war more palatable. And this is the approach on non-lethals. And we're going to see, as this so-called war on terrorism grows, the use of non-lethal weapons will expand geometrically. And it won't be just our foreign adversaries. As the Secretary of the Air Force has indicated, it's going to be tried out here at home first, make sure it's all safe and good so we don't do anything to our adversaries that we wouldn't want to do to grandma in a protest over economic issues, for instance. Because these are the places where they're intending to use these technologies in what they call riot control, which usually is peaceful protest agitated by government and problems that really don't deserve this kind of response to Americans. We're coming up on the break. We're going to get into some more of today's news. If you want to call in, it's 800-313-9443. And you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World. Welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN Live. You know, we're still talking about today's news a little bit, you know, talking just before the break about some of the non-lethal weapons. You know, we've covered these issues in the past in a number of books and videos. I want to mention our website for getting information on that material. It's www.earthpulse.com, EARTHPULSE, earthpulse.com. And we have a toll-free number for information on our books, and I can give that as 888-690-1277. Again, 888-690-1277. You know, over the years, we've dealt with a lot of these issues and just, you know, taking a look at the news and seeing sort of how things are emerging in these stories. You know, one of the big issues we've covered in the past is InfoWar, the idea of information becoming sort of the area of not just the traditional propaganda, but actually manipulating information systems, hacking into information systems, which now everything depends on, from our utilities, even this radio network, quite frankly. I mean, everyone depends on technologies that are accessible through connections to a larger and worldwide, ultimately worldwide network. So a couple of stories. These are great. Again, one of them from September 15th, one of them from September 13th. The one from September 13th that says, headline, Chinese secrets can't be hidden from web sleuths. Nations worry about terrorists using the tips. And what's happening, and it's a headline, citizen spies, is because hacking is such a widespread phenomena, and almost anyone can do it with the right expertise, they've hacked in to Chinese military sites, research sites. They've also, the Chinese, quite frankly, on a story I talked about a few weeks ago, have hacked into the Joint Chiefs of the United States military's personal and confidential sites. So when you start to see this, gathering knowledge and that knowledge funneling to the wrong hands is becoming a bigger and bigger problem. In fact, even in Muslim countries, in Morocco, there's a story, and it's called, in the story headline from September 15th, another AP story, and it says, hacker's conviction is also a sign of technological progress. Morocco, few defend the teen's crime, but many see it as evidence of moving ahead, unquote. You know, that headline and that story, both of those stories indicate a very, very different scenario. I mean, think about this. You know, the type of international terrorism people are concerned about is certainly something to be concerned about. But this idea of being able to remotely engage in things that totally cripple or damage the U.S. economy or infrastructure from a distance is the work of huge amounts of research, not on the part of just independent citizens, but governments. I mean, We do it. The Chinese do it. The Israelis do it. The Russians do it. Everybody engaged in high science is looking at ways to penetrate the infrastructure. In other words, if you could shut down the power grid or shut down the phone systems, shut down the internet systems in terms of their impact on commerce, or affect the computers that run Wall Street. I mean, think about how technologically dependent we are, and these systems remain vulnerable. You know, even after all of the security and revamping of Y2K, where we saw all that money spent to revamp systems, this kind of issue really needs a huge amount of resources pumped into it, because these systems can be safeguarded. We can do the kinds of things that are necessary on a national level. At the same time, those very same technologies offer the greatest challenges to our personal privacy. And this is where the balance is always being struck by somebody in a dark room with a big fat cigar smoking and making decisions for the rest of us. And it's in those smoke-filled rooms where all of this nonsense begins. And there's a balance, absolutely a balance. But we're being inflicted and infected with fear as our way of sort of calming the crowd or moving the herd, you know, and that's not what this country is about. It's not a country that should be founded and motivated by fear, but quite the opposite. You know, we have a constitutional government, a democratic republic that means something to most Americans and means very little to most multinational corporations who are directing way too much of this country's traffic. In terms of both politics and outcomes. And, you know, starting the day, just kind of working our way through these subjects today, just from the news occurring in the last month or so, really starts to speak to all of us about the direction in which this country is going. Here's a money line. This is September 11th, 2006, USA Today, and it's their front page story in their money section, Section B, and it says, "Caution and pessimism follow 9/11. Investors won't pay much for stocks now." But then they get into this discussion about security equipment, you know, and they get into this: security generates multi-billion-dollar business. The scope of contracts widens as global demand blooms. And they're talking about, here's the latest, the bomb check devices. Well, we can all identify with those. Send the thing through the bag through the scanner. The next one, this one gets a little more invasive. They got a little finger scan where you can register at the traveler's kiosk for being the trusted traveler and give up your fingerprint. You know, we used to do that with criminals. We do that with everybody now. Coming back after the break, I want to get back into this personal privacy issue because we're being run over. So stay tuned. This is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we're talking about technology issues. And just before the break, we were starting to talk about an article on privacy issues. And one of these things that we were just talking about is this idea of the trusted traveler program that will utilize fingerprints or other biometric information. You know, fingerprints used to be used for identifying criminals. You know, they use them at banks, they use them in cashing checks, they want to use them in airports. And it's really just another step along the way. You know, we researched privacy technologies in the books Earth Rising, The Revolution, Earth Rising 2. And in those, you know, the ultimate ID and where they eventually want to go is DNA, the most positive ID they figure there is. But more than that, it gives a full profile of health potentials and a whole bunch of factors dealing with us as individual humans, a very, very huge amount of data. And the question becomes, is as these evolve, are we going to allow that to happen? Are we going to support that? You know, one of the other big inventions now being used at San Francisco Airport, get this, it's the shoe scanner for the shoe bombers. And I suppose this is necessary, but, you know, huge amounts of money are being spent on this while other issues are not being dealt with, the big issues. You know, they haven't even been able to find someone to take the office that deals with information security for the country. I mean, they set up Homeland Security. Nobody even wants to touch that one. No one will even take the job because they figure it's a loser. I mean, they're going to not succeed in that job. That attitude and what it's breeding in terms of real security is not there. We have to accept the fact that we're vulnerable in certain areas and then go do the things we need to do to improve our security in the appropriate areas. At the same time, we need to analyze really what's been going on with this whole issue of personal privacy. You know, the Bush issue lately on the CIA abuses that has kind of been in and out of the news. You know, when we stop and think about, forget all the propaganda and the rhetoric from both sides, because there's been piles of it, more than we need. But think about the fact that they want to modify the Geneva Convention, which has been fairly operational as far as I can tell. I mean, it always hasn't been enforced, I grant you that. But since 1949, it's been a standard that, you know, that at least we believed in or tried to believe in or expressed that. And what we see, this discussion of, oh, everyone's in constitutional compliance, but they want to change the Geneva Convention. And here's the dilemma. Is they're not in constitutional compliance. The Supreme Court ruled on this issue. The fact is they've got to be brought into compliance. So there's only one way to do that, is through legislation, which is what they're trying to accomplish. But these are international agreements. Those open the door to lots of other discussions that aren't being had. This isn't just about what's happening at the moment, but it's about this debate about when and where the Constitution applies. And this is important because there's a document we found going back to 1989. It's called The Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War. It was produced by the U.S. Army War College. And it talks about all of these great new technologies that'll trample over American values. I mean, they basically spell it out. They say, you know, these things will violate American values, you know, such as juries, judges, courts. They actually got into this in that paper. They talked about the idea that we have the capability of knocking out an aircraft using an electromagnetic pulse, a surge of energy that would override its electronics, cause the aircraft to crash. And when they went to do the analysis, they'd say, oh, nothing wrong here. It must be pilot error. That's the way they would be able to chalk these up. And they had this little debate in this paper by the U.S. Army War College, that this little discussion, about how that might be acceptable because, after all, we're outside of the boundaries of the country and maybe the Constitution doesn't apply. Now, if you use that principle, and I don't believe in that, I don't think most listeners to this network believe that, because the fact of the matter is every one of our sons and daughters swear out an allegiance to that Constitution. And that's what we expect them to be carrying around the country. I mean, we hear George Bush talking about democratization of the Middle East. You know, it seems to me the Constitution ought to travel along in front of that, not behind it. And the Constitution speaks to self-determination, the idea of people to be able to determine their own outcomes, and that government springs from the people. And it doesn't appear to me, in fact, most observers, that the Middle East wants the kind of government that we've got. You know, maybe we don't want the kind of government that we got, at least in its present form. We want to get back what we used to have. And if we got that back and we had that expressed in American values, we wouldn't be in the conflicts that we're in around the world right now, because it's not democracy that people are objecting to. It's not self-determination, which is the ultimate form of democracy, is the right to decide what kind of government we want. They're entitled to that just as much as we are, and no one should be imposing on us or anyone else what that form of government is, whether we like it or not. Now, when people trample on our twin towers, you know, we do what we got to do, and we did that in Afghanistan very effectively, you know, going in. Why are we still there? It's to protect so-called American interests. And whose interests are those? Those are not our interests. You know, I think we finished the job. We stomped them into the Stone Age. It's time to leave. If they don't like, you know, what happened there, then, you know, don't attack us again, and don't harbor criminals that do. You know, and that's really an appropriate approach. In Iraq, the CIA admits now, and here it is. It's a September 15th article. It says on a Washington Post article, CIA knew Bin Laden, Iraq weren't linked. Panel report says. You know, I mean, we all know by this stage what was really going on there was about oil and gas. It was about stomping out a guy that kind of got in our way because, you know, he wasn't doing what we told him to do anymore. And you got to remember, you know, Saddam, we helped him back when he was fighting Iraq or Iran in the Iraqi-Iranian war. We provided chemical weapons, biological technology, so he could launch a reasonable fight against Iran. Why was Iran attacking? It was over the same conflict that is there right now. It's within the Muslim faith, these factions that are fighting one another. And Iranians believe, and, you know, whatever their cause is, they're willing to pursue it. Now, there's some big problems with the misjudgments because we backed the Shah of Iran going back to the 1950s by the CIA, getting rid of their government, giving them the Shah. The Shah was known for torturing his own people for decades. We supported that. We provided them U.S. military technologies because they were the front gate to the old Cold War Soviet Union threat. Well, the people there eventually revolted and got a very hostile government towards us. And people were mad at us for supporting the guy they had, the tyrant they had. We then backed Saddam. Saddam got out of control when he ran into Kuwait. So, you know, all those bets were off. And, you know, here we are today in this same situation. But what was really going on was we took a state-owned oil company. It was owned by the people of Iraq. No matter what form of government they had, it was still their oil. And now we've privatized it. We gave it to all of those George Bush buddies in the oil and gas industry and all the people that rebuild the place, like Halliburton, which gave Cheney on his way out. Remember, he was an officer there, and Halliburton running the show for him. And when he left to run for vice president, they gave him a $20 million parting gift. Of course, that was just severance pay. Wouldn't want to imply that he was ever going to do anything for that kind of money, although Halliburton did win some multi-billion dollar no-bid contracts to rebuild a country he'll blow up. You know, the thing is, you know, we are not going to be, we are in a Vietnam in the Middle East on a, in an ideology that does not line up with our own. We helped them get a democracy. They elected a parliament. That parliament decided to partition their own country into three regions that would be autonomous and self-governing. We didn't like it, so we intervened again. We said, hey, we don't want you to do this. You know, at what point do we give them their democracy and let them make their own decisions? And if we don't like them and they work against us, truly work against us, you know, then we have to intervene. But these are right of self-determination. Do we like what they're deciding? Maybe not. But, you know, they don't like what we're deciding either. Maybe it's time to look at a lack of imposition and a little respect between governments and a little less interference. You know, if every time they get caught interfering with our government, some foreign country, whether it be Israel caught spying on Americans or Chinese getting spied on Americans or the Russians or whoever it is, we are pretty incensed, and yet we're engaging in other people's domestic affairs on a fairly regular basis. And I'm not just talking about the places we're in conflict today, but this has been our pattern for decades, and when we look at that pattern and what it yields, it's usually not a good result. If we line up with people that ideologically we're not there with them, you know, we're just flat not there with them. We don't share the same worldview. We don't share the same values, then we ought not to be there with them at all. We ought not to support their economies. We ought to not support what they're doing. I mean, why are we supporting these governments around the world at unprecedented levels? Does it really serve American interests? Does it really serve yours and my values? And these are things that I think Americans rightly should be questioning and not buying into everybody's latest spin on the national press. But even the national press, you know, here it is today again in the Associated Press. After Bush loses all this in the Supreme Court, they compromise a little bit in the legislature at the congressional level. Even his own party is split on the issues because it's kind of overreaching, and even they can see it. Everybody can see it. We don't want an unsecure country. We want a strong national defense, but we want one that honors American values. And going back to that issue, that paper, The Revolution of Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War, it talked about all these new technologies. When the U.S. Army War College published that, they said, you know, only in an environment of fear, right, would we be willing to lay down our American values and accept these new technologies that fly in the face of those values. Now think about this for a moment. U.S. Army War College saying, hey, we need an environment of fear in order for people to step back and buy into this. Well, you know, I look at that and I go, now that should be the place where everybody stops. If they conflict with American values, then we ought to have American debate in an American way so that we could all come to a general consensus about what our government ought to look like and what it ought to do with these most powerful technologies. And yet it didn't say that. It said in this paper that what should happen is create an environment of fear, and it suggested in 1989 that this be done using international terrorism and international drug trafficking as the vehicle. Now, international terrorism, and I've said it before many, many times, has killed maybe, including all the soldiers and servicemen and women that we've lost, in this war. We've lost maybe 5,000 or 6,000 people in the last 10 years, which is a huge number. To medical malpractice in this country, we've lost 1 million people. Both are huge problems. One is much bigger than the other, and yet which one generates the news coverage and the budget, and which one is the most solvable? Medical malpractice, most of its drug interactions that could be resolved by proper databases, managing our prescriptions in a secure way so that we don't get drug interactions by various physicians prescribing the wrong things or maybe just making a mistake. You know, here we are looking at a fear environment. What does that yield? It yields exactly what we have, an overreaching government. And the belief of this government is, and from this paper, is that somehow the Constitution doesn't apply, so all of these sinister acts that are occurring outside of the country that we would never allow, that the Geneva Convention doesn't even allow, which we bought into as a civil society, and here we are engaging in activity that most Americans should be strongly objecting to. And then it goes even further where they're saying, let's test it out on Americans first, these new technologies, these new non-lethal weapons, so we can extract whatever it is they're trying to extract out of foreign prisoners. And, you know, I have no problem with due process law. I have no problem in a war environment taking some extraordinary measures. But, you know, 5 years is a long time to keep someone incarcerated without charges. It's not something that was permitted in this country for the last couple hundred years. And it's something we really, really need a thorough discussion about. And we're not getting it. We're not getting it from this administration. We're not getting it from an unbalanced Congress. And yet the real threats, the threats that we need to be concerned about, aren't being dealt with effectively. I mean, here's an example of that. And this is from August 28th. And it's Iran tests new missile from sub. Anti-ship, the move underscores its ability to disrupt tanker traffic. Well, there's more in this article. It also talks about the Israelis holding three nuclear-capable subs and getting ready to buy two more. Now, submarines are one of the only ways of delivering a nuclear warhead. And we're not hearing much about this with Iran. But Iran having this capability to actually get in close to a country where this kind of weapon can be used with no, there's no countermeasures to that. There's nothing available right now that's at least not in the open literature saying that there's something available that could guard against that threat. This is why there's initiatives in the new silent or the underwater sonars for catching these silent submarines, very quiet submarines, because it is, in fact, one of the biggest threats. When you think about Iran possessing the technology, being able to get close into any of the, through the Mediterranean or through the rest of the oceans, getting fairly close, we could have some serious repercussions from that. The Israelis, at the same time, being able to get in close, the same is true. You know, there's going to come a point where the nuclear programs are going to become threatening enough to Israel and to their approach to the world and their worldview that we'll see the preemptive strikes. And those things have been legitimized by our government. Preemption is acceptable, but it now works for everyone. And so who's there first wins is basically the new paradigm in war declaring and war fighting. You don't even declare it. You just do it. That's, you know, that creates a very unsettling environment. And when you look at the whole situation in the Middle East, and we talked about this on this program a few weeks ago, the situation in terms of the mindset that the radicals involved in this war against the West believe that, you know, if you die in that war, that you're martyred if you're a Muslim. So they don't have any problem sort of blowing up the whole works and letting God sort it out. In fact, it's kind of the quick way to the finish line for many people's belief system. Yet these are the mindsets that we're entangling ourselves with in conflicts that we really have to analyze much more fundamentally. I mean, the war on terrorism is a legitimate one. It's one that is not going to ever go away, and it's one that's fueled by hatred, generally fueled by people stepping on each other's values systems. And this has to do with sovereignty and what nations are all about. And, you know, today's show, you know, we're talking about a lot of things in the news and a lot of ideas. I've got Maryland and California hanging in. Maryland, are you still with me?
Yes.
You had something you wanted to add to this conversation today.
I was, you had spoken about Ahmadinejad And I find it interesting, if you look at the history of Ahmadinejad, I guess I'm sure you've seen this, there's allegations that he was one of the main captors of the U.S. hostages back in 1979. He appears to have come on the scene kind of out of nowhere. Today you see Ahmadinejad being accused by U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson in China. He made kind of a funny comment.
Hold on, Marilyn. We're going to the break, but I want to continue this right after the break. Stay with me. This is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we have Marilyn still hanging in with us in California. And you were just starting to talk about the Iranian president's ties to the capture of the hostages way back during the Carter administration. Go ahead, Marilyn, where you left
off. You can find out, somebody has archived, you know, on Wikipedia you can add information. Somebody's done a lot of archiving of this stuff on Wikipedia under controversy surrounding Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. But it just appears to me, and this is women's intuition, that this guy is not who he says he is. And I say this because he is a convenient patsy, just like Saddam Hussein and, who's the other guy over in Kosovo that was demonized for being a butcher of Milosevic. My suspicion is this guy may actually be highly level controlled by the same people running the United States. Now, I know that sounds bizarre, but he really has done some strange things. He's polarizing people, which always...
Right.
It, you know, tips me off. You've got the far right, the real ultra patriots, saying, "Oh, this guy actually is an honest guy, and just listen to him; he sounds really good." But then you have him staging things like dances with fake jars of what was it, plutonium or something, which are almost satanic in nature.
Right.
And then you see how he, from the very start, seemed to be a patsy for the United States, because when if you look on Wikipedia, you see where he wanted to have the Russian embassy taken over, and I'm trying to find it where I saw this, instead of the U.S. embassy. And then supposedly when Khomeini, his idol, stated, this was the news, no, let's go for the U.S. embassy, he relented and said, oh, okay, let's go for the U.S. embassy and take them over. And now you see him fitting quite grandly in the scheme of taking over Iran. He's providing a perfect reason to take over Iran. And today you have Paulson, I guess it's today or yesterday, in China, made this obtuse comment that Iran was, quote, abusing the global financial system and putting its security at risk. Now, whenever you get into the money, then things really start rocking and rolling.
Right. Part of that is the counterfeiting going on. They figure in Iran and in North Korea. And this counterfeiting is undermining U.S. currency because it is so perfect, even with the latest revisions. And it's, again, this kind of warfare that's fought without bullets and bombs. And this technique of interfering with our economic structure is making people really mad. And those are the guys that are going to decide who pushes the next button, because now they're hitting those corporate interests and ultimately the backers of Treasury notes, which are corporate interests.
What did you think about this recent so-called meeting of non-aligned nations? Now, knowing what I know, the aligned nations are those the ones that have been already brought under control by the globalist cadre, whoever, you know, whatever they are.
Yeah, I think...
Were those people for real? Or it seems like some of those people actually were already aligned, but they were in the so-called non-aligned.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing there are what maybe better is phrased the disenfranchised, the people that feel like either they've been imposed on or somehow they've been trampled on by the U.S. And, you know, unfortunately, our foreign policy has yielded that with a lot of nations. And, you know, we have a lot of reconstruction. Hang on, Marilyn, we're going to the break, but I want to continue this because this is a big part of where we're headed in the 21st century. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich on the Republic Broadcasting Network. And welcome back to the second hour of Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we're here from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. And the research material that we use in this program in all of our work is provided by the Lay Institute, a Texas nonprofit corporation. You can see their website at layinstitute.org. And you can also check out my website at earthpulse.com, E-A-R-T-H-P-U-L-S-E. Marilyn, are you still hanging in there with me?
Yes.
All right. We're into a little bit short segment again, but I want you to go ahead and continue on your comments, because I think they're pretty relevant for today.
Well, and I was talking about Ahmadinejad and where he came from, and
right.
My suspicions that he may not, if he is a true opponent of the people running the United States, then he's broken rank at some point, and I think that may have been what Saddam Hussein did, because it's well known that he was actually put in power and supported by, you know, visited by Rumsfeld and Ellis,
yep.
Now in control.
Right, and you see the same thing. I mean, in Panama, where we decided Noriega was going to be the drug trafficking villain we needed to catch. Well, you know, we have him buried in a prison. You know, he's in a prison where he can't get interviewed because he has so much information about our own complicity with illegal activities through Central Intelligence and others in his part of the world that we took him, we brought him to this country, we tried him, and we put him in a hole. And really, when you start to look at that sort of approach, how can we wonder why we're in some of the conflicts that we're in today? I mean, when you're talking about this guy turning a different direction, you know, that's where, look at Osama bin Laden. The CIA trained him when they were fighting in Afghanistan, the Russians, when they were occupying the country. And, you know, we trained him, and now he's using that training as our adversary. And this is the root of a lot of the problem, is if you look at the very value systems that drive these people, our good judgment as Americans would say, hey, we're not working with you because your values don't line up with my values, and so we're not doing business. I'll give you a good example. Is I produce a product here in the U.S. that's a product that originated in China, and I put it on the market recently, and this product is made in the U.S., in California, in very controlled conditions. But the day after I launched it, I had a couple of companies from China immediately contact me, want to supply at a better price, of course. And my answer to them was, I don't want to do business with you. And they, you know, they were persistent over weeks. And finally I said, look, when you change your government and it represents the kind of values that I believe in, then I'm happy to trade with you. And I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm not trading with China, in that sense. And, you know, the guy was pretty incensed about it, but, you know, that's how our American policy should be driven, by real values that represent who we are to the rest of the world, where we actually demonstrate it in what we do.
We actually put them where they are after World War II, so
right.
We have to get rid of our government, the people running our place, to ever exert any control over these clowns, and they now are just about being set up to run the world the way things are going.
Well, they are. In fact, you know, the Chinese use a philosopher, Sun Tzu, who's ancient, several thousand years old, and Mao applied his principles. His principles are taught in the book Art of War in every military academy in the world. The Chinese applied it. That's how they won their revolution. They're applying it right now. Every listener, it's a very short book. Get it at your library, The Art of War, and read it, and you'll see how they're playing it out. And they used our system, capitalism, to really build their productive capacity at unprecedented levels, at just unbelievable levels. And the result of all of this advancement is we have created the biggest adversary we'll ever see, with 1 billion people and a rumbling economy that's dwarfing ours, and with the production capacity that we will never have again unless we start to recognize what's happening within these political adversaries, because they are adversaries on an ideological level, which makes them adversaries on every level. And we need to respect boundaries, belief systems, but we also need to respect the values of this country. This is Dr. Nick Begich, Changing the Way We See the World. And hang in there, Marilyn. We want to continue the dialogue because I think we're headed down a good path, and it'll wake us up for this election season. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And Marilyn, are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, go ahead. We're going to go ahead and let you continue for a few minutes, and then we're going to jump to Jeff in New Mexico. But these are big issues. You know, how do we get involved in these situations, and then what do they really represent on the other end? And, you know, the non-aligned nations, which you were talking about a little bit ago, you know, this, you know, who are they really? And what are their complaints? And are some of those complaints legitimate? And I think we, you know, we need to really ask ourselves some of those questions. And, you know, a lot of times you can be out in the field and you're picking up the dung, but, you know, it can turn into fertilizer when we recognize what it is. And, you know, we need to take stock in what our American policy, our foreign policy has done, what it continues to do, and then make people accountable to represent American values, not corporate interests and corporate values, but Americans' values that we share in common. And then I think we see a much different shape of the world. Respect for sovereignty and respect for self-determination really is where democracy, if we really believe in a democratic republic, has to begin.
Just a real quick comment about this non-aligned nation. Of course, Hugo Chavez, who is out in the open against the United States,
yes,
out in the open, who knows what's behind all that. You just made the comment that he's Venezuela is going to be providing, I think it was heating oil, you said, for remote villages in Alaska.
That's right. It was
in
our front page story today.
Very bizarre. I'll go back to Iran. This is something I'm not sure if it's true or not, but back, you know, Stratfor Intelligence, have you heard of that website that supposedly puts out things that are going on in the world as far as intelligence briefings?
Yes.
Stratfor in June 4th of 2002, and I don't know whether this is true or not, this is a briefing they put out about Iran that an appearance by Russian Deputy Chief of Staff General Uri Bayuevsky, I don't know how I'm pronouncing it right, he pretty much said at that point that Iran already had nuclear capability. So
yeah,
if that is true, all of this is just a red herring designed to bring about some kind of a revolution in Iran and secure, it appears to me, more of the world oil-producing supply and consolidating. You see the companies consolidating. Now the supplies seem to be, they seem to be targeting, consolidating the supplies. Could you make comment on that, and then please I'll get off?
Yeah, I think all of that is likely the case. I mean, if you're going to create unrest within a country, it's preferable to attacking it. So anything that they can do there, that's certainly part of our foreign policy approach. And you know, once again, you know, when we're directly threatened and the nuclear capability of Iran, most of the world recognizes it already has it. There's also this 25, the equivalent of 25 nuclear suitcase-sized bombs and plutonium that is misplaced from the former Soviet Union, and perhaps a lot more than that. And so, you know, this is not a problem that's going to go away. It doesn't start or end with Iran. It really is just an ongoing problem. We have to figure out ways to solve it. Monitoring plutonium movements through proper surveillance types of technology, I think, is a legitimate technology to be developed at a pretty rapid rate right now. Marilyn, thank you for the call and the great comments. I think it's added a lot to this debate. We have Jeff still hanging in New Mexico, I believe.
Hi.
Hi, Jeff. You had something you wanted to add to this conversation today.
Yeah, first off, we don't need a paid president to be a commander-in-chief implementing a containment doctrine against terrorism. Unpaid congressmen could vote a containment doctrine in, and an unpaid Secretary of Defense and the rest of the military could carry out the containment doctrine against terrorism. But the Middle East is out of the United States jurisdiction anyway.
Right.
And conservative lawmakers and governors and presidents often lecture the ordinary people that the most virtuous way to earn their keep is through running their own business or laboring in a factory or on a farm for some boss or middle manager in a corporate-type plant. To wish for easy money in an easy government job or through a government grant is taboo. So why not require that our lawmakers and governors do their government jobs without a taxpayer-funded or inflation-causing salary? If they are so much for the free market and real businesses producing real products for consumers, they should have saved up enough money in their years prior to government service when they were making enough money doing a real job to have a humble lifestyle for the few years that they want to or the public wants them to be living as a public servant.
Yeah. You know, you raise a good point, Jeff. You know, when I look back, like Alaska, we have what's called a citizen legislature. The pay is nothing. I mean, it basically covers your gas.
I didn't know that.
And it's a 4-month session. The rest of the year, you know, these guys are making about $24,000 a year, which, Anyone who makes a living in Alaska knows that's, in fact, for a family of four, it's well below the low income level, to the poverty level. You know, but the fact is, you know, they're supposed to have a real job and a real profession. And, you know, I mean, when you think about world leaders, you know, people do have professions, you know. Jesus Christ was a carpenter, for goodness sake. You know, service requires that you actually engage in work that is productive. A full-time Congress and the way that it's been configured these days, you know, really doesn't speak well. I mean, when you look back at the founding fathers, and I know their salaries weren't there. I mean, they barely made the pony ride to the White House and the Capitol building. The fact of the matter is, you know, public service has changed dramatically, and there's some pretty good examples of how badly it's gone. When you have the arrogance and the pork barrel politics, I mean, the arrogance of hiding, and I apologize to the rest of the country for our Senator Stevens, who tried to block a disclosure bill that would allow us to look on the Internet and see who was moving legislation, who was blocking and holding legislation, and where all the federal money was going. And we ought to be able to get that off the Internet and scrutinize it as citizens and be able to comment on how our money's being spent. And this kind of invisibility by government, hiding all of this, does not work in our national interest, nor does it work in our individual interest, nor does it serve the cause of liberty in this country at all. It serves only the cause of those that would wish to hide how that money is being spent, who don't want to be acknowledged for $1,500 hammers and $1,000 toilet seats. And the reality is, these congressional leaders have used pork barrel spending to entice us in their jurisdictions to sort of acquiesce and look the other way. This is a mistake. We need to take a broader view of this country and start weaving together a fabric that doesn't look like grandma's quilt because of special interest politics, but looks like the fine fabric of American character that we used to have here. And, Jeff, I appreciate the call, and I appreciate the comment. You know, when we talk on RBN, one of the great things about the RBN network is the ability to bring these issues out and really kind of talk about them in a sort of a different vein. You know, how much is service worth? What does service get us these days? And what are the things that influence those political outcomes and have changed government from one that used to lift people up to one that presses people down? I mean, no one goes, oh, great, the government is here, when they knock on your door. You know, that's a sad state of affairs when a government of the people, by the people, and for the people has forgotten the people and have now served interests that never were they intended to serve on a platform of corruption. You know, in a lot of states, you have the ability to get initiatives on the ballot. I encourage people to get initiatives that reduce the amount of money that can go into campaigns, that limits it so people actually have to convince somebody besides a 30-second spot that they're worth voting for. You know, we need to look at government accountability at all levels as one of the big themes in this election and future elections, and it is. I mean, what is all this about? It's about ending some of this special interest corruption, and we have to call it for what it is. Let's not give it the politically correct nice names of political activism and participation by corporate America, because that's not what it is, because the average citizen cannot walk into their congressman's office and write that $10,000 check. They're not going to get that lunch to try and influence how he might vote or she might vote on some important piece of legislation. We need to end this cult of corruption that's become Washington, D.C. You know, issues in our papers here in Alaska, we do get some decent news coverage, you know, and I'm looking at a paper right after the primaries, and we ousted this longtime Republican establishment guy with a new Republican face, a face of ethics, which is pretty remarkable. The same thing, we got a deal from Rumsfeld in our paper because we've got the missile defense system here in the same front page. It's talking about the missile defense that's failed, and they spent billions and billions on this system, and it's still programmed for failure. Then we have on the same front page, we have Alaska may become the test area for drones, and a $90 million program to use surveillance drones to test them here so they can use them broadly across the country in police forces, surveillance activities where they don't have to use manned spacecraft with cameras mounted on these. Now, what's so interesting about these drones is they do much better than satellite. You can, for instance, survey a railroad, and if you're 2 inches out, you can actually note that, and that way the railroad bed gets stabilized. So, I mean, I can see some things that they can be used for, but the cameras are so efficient. These planes weigh 40 pounds. They'll fly 20-hour missions. Think about that, 20-hour missions of photographing at that scale your neighborhood, you know? And the idea of using surveillance drones, it seems like, oh, well, they'll only be used in a few instances. What's the big deal? Let me tell you, something that weighs 40 pounds costs nothing to manufacture in mass. And the idea of greater and greater levels of security and higher levels of personal privacy invasions, whether they be from the air in cheap drone aircraft or in cameras mounted on your street corner. And we've dealt with these issues. Privacy is, in fact, the big risk for the 21st century. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Please pass that word on to others so they can tune in if you find this show worthwhile. Today, I'm covering just a smattering of news, all of it relevant to where we are today. We try and tie it together to make a little bit more sense. You know, technology trends really are the trends that determine which governments are strong and which are weak in the 21st century. Within democratic republics, it's incumbent, it's required that all of us have at least an understanding of what some of these technologies are and how they might reach into our lives. And at the same time, in gaining that understanding, it's about acting on it in a way that is responsible, that redirects what is otherwise a misdirected journey that unfortunately we have been riders on for too long. You know, when you look around the world and you see what countries are powerful, they are in fact those with the highest and best technologies, which means in a democratic republic, we ought to be able to debate at least the concepts, the ideas behind the technologies. We don't need to know how to build the most sophisticated missile any more than we know how to fix our car or work on the wiring in our electronic watch, but we certainly can use them. We can use them and direct them in terms of how these things go, and I think that's true with the things we're covering today. The research is provided by the layinstitute.org. LAYinstitute.org. Take a look at our site and find out a little bit about the purposes of the Lay Institute as a nonprofit. Our material, our books and literature DVDs are available at earthpulse.com, earthpulse.com. You know, right before the break, we were starting to talk a little bit more about the personal privacy issues. And these, you know, these issues are increasingly in the news. In fact, some of the technologies the European Parliament has started to call technologies of political control. I mean, think about that for a minute. The European Parliament recognizing privacy-related invasive technologies as the technologies of political control. And within their documents, they talk about, and this is largely driven by Eastern Europeans and those of the generation that remember what much of Europe was like during the 40s, during occupation by Nazi Germany. And the reality of these kinds of oppressive governments is it imprints on people why basic freedoms, why freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, the ability to be free of government interference is so fundamental to democracies and democratic republics, or any form of government where free people are making those determinations. And so when you look at the technology, it's changed a lot. We look at Europe and sort of how it's shaped up. I mean, in Great Britain, if you enter London, you're the most surveyed. You're going to be seen by over 100 cameras in the course of a day or two wandering around London. From the time you enter to the time you exit, your movements are absolutely recoverable. And in most major cities today, that's the case, and cameras are getting smaller. Think of a little camera on your computer, about a tenth of an inch cubed, to fill up that space. Those are very cheap to produce in mass. And the prediction is, within this next decade, not just major metropolitan areas will be able to be surveyed, but entire nations. What does that mean? You know, the idea of, in Great Britain, they use it with several different ways. They have, like, for instance, as many as 200 television screens with cameras hooked to one guy reviewing them. But the way it works, software determines who's making hostile movements with their hands, or if a gunshot is fired, pickups, microphones triangulate the position and zoom in on those locations. So for safety and security, once again, being discussed and the trade-offs and the presumption of privacy. I mean, walk down the street in a major city today and you absolutely have no, absolutely zero presumption of privacy. Whatever you say, whatever you do is being recorded, potentially. And that type of potential ought not to exist within a free society. And when it does, we have to question the very mechanisms that have allowed this to take place. And it goes further than this. Think about all of your purchases, all of the things that are centralized through credit cards, medical records, corporate records, private records, income tax returns. I mean, go through the laundry list, even down to your discount card at the grocery store. And what you see is a huge amount of data, what Europeans call data valence, which is derived from that data. That's like surveillance with the data in the front end. And they look at material, look at the profile of individuals and people, and use that essentially to profile large segments of the population. These are technologies that are being used right now by the U.S. government in ways to isolate those that are opposed to American policy. And get this, last hour we were talking about non-lethal weapons and the fact that there's these protocols between Department of Defense and Department of Justice. Within those protocols, interestingly enough, they use language that's almost exactly the same language used in the chemical and biological treaties that were signed off a number of years ago by a bunch of nations. And what that treaty allowed for was domestic use of non-lethal gas and chemical and biologicals within your domestic nation. In other words, within your sovereign state, you could do what you couldn't do against a declared enemy. Now, that's in the chemical and biological treaty. There's no U.S. law that forbids using those same chemicals that are forbidden against your enemies can be used locally. Then you look at the non-lethal developmental language that says essentially exactly the same thing. And who are these people that can be targeted? Those opposed to American policy. Now, isn't that interesting? Right in that joint directive between the Department of Defense, Department of Justice, to on a priority basis develop non-lethals when they can be used against Americans, to echo on September 12th the CNN report of the Secretary of the Air Force talking about testing non-lethals on Americans, civilians, before we go and use it against declared enemies. All of it permitted, all of it encouraged within these regulations, and yet we're the subject of them. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World. Call in at 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. And we've been talking about technology, the impacts of technology, and some of the things in the news. If you want to get in on this conversation for this last half hour today, it is 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. You know, looking at sort of the trends, again, in technology, this privacy issue and looking at how the Europeans sort of view it, I think it's constructive for us, you know, because over time, you know, when things disappear, like generation after generation, a little bit at a time, people tend to forget what really was and what is and how these things end up playing out in the long run. When we see governments stripping away liberty and privacy, at the same time, they're building their ability to hide more and more of what they do behind cover of darkness. I think we need to start taking stock in what this government is doing. The most recent controversy, trying to hide the national budget and hide the effect of people who actually block legislation by putting holds on legislation. You know, we need a transparent government. You know, that's how this was intended to be. And now the very tools that are being used against us are the tools that should be providing us that greater level of visibility. When you think about the Internet, for example, you know, the idea of being able to look at the whole federal budget, see how legislation's moving, who's holding it up, who's moving it forward, and really see that tied together would allow people, independent researchers, and to tie the news coverage and the political rhetoric to those stalls and movements so we could start to get a better picture of the true fabric of influence and outcomes within our Congress. And transparency is a phrase, is a word used in Europe and has been for over a decade when referring to government and when referring to initiatives within government and making government a lot more accountable. And that's something that we sort of missed that transparency movement on this side of the ocean, but it's something we ought to be looking at. You know, and the idea of whistleblower mechanisms, we talked a little bit about some of that last hour. Mostly we think about whistleblower mechanisms as oriented towards government. But private sector, in some instances, can be even more abusive. You know, now you've got private sector companies that are as big as some nations, produce bigger revenues and surpluses than many nations have in entire national budgets. And these multinational corporations have very little oversight. And the fact of the matter is sometimes they work against our national interest. Sometimes they work against humanity's interest generally across the planet. And when that happens, there really is no mechanism for private persons within those companies or around those companies to come forward and blow the whistle on people that are working against the rest of us in ways that really ought to be looked at and scrutinized. That type of mechanism needs to be built, and it needs to be built to provide the kind of accountability that makes not just governments responsible, but private companies responsible. And, you know, capitalism is a great thing, but capitalism without consciousness is just a radical form of economics. Think about how the Russians approach it today. I mean, they saw capitalism as a sort of ruthless game, and look at how it projects itself into their political life and their makeup based on their perception of it. Values-driven capitalistic motives that are driven by American values or appropriate values to their place, I think really can generate much greater yields for the country, and at the same time maintain our industries and our independence. You know, the things that made America independent were our independence in food production, being able to produce our own weapon systems, quite frankly, our own technologies, our own sustainable resource developments that yielded one of the most, if the most powerful economy on the planet. You know, when you think about what we've all done together in this country, it's quite remarkable. And if we can continue to develop, but on a little bit different line, instead of just always the corporate line, making sure that our values are reflected in the institutions that we create. You know, it's the same with corporations. You know, when you look back at corporations, their founding entities, you know, a lot of them had really big ideas and a conscious view of the world. I mean, think of Henry Ford. You know, he had paid double the wage rates at one point. When he was starting out, he kind of figured out, hey, if my assembly workers can't afford the cars they're making, this will never be a big market. And so he took an approach that was much different. You know, and companies change because the founders go, and so those kind of ideas come and go. But those that maintain conscious-driven companies tend to be around a long time, and they also make a lot of money for everyone. And then we attack them, you know, because maybe they don't get political enough. You know, I think about Microsoft. You know, a lot of people don't like Microsoft. They think they got a monopoly. Well, most innovative garage tinkerers we've ever seen come out on top. It's kind of nice to see that that kind of capitalism works. They spend billions of dollars on things that are important to them. They haven't gotten involved in a lot of government and politics buying because it hasn't been their game. And man, do they have repercussions from that? You know, and I'm sure they're getting more political as time goes on because survival as a company that size, unfortunately, almost necessitates it. And, you know, these are the things, again, you know, American genius in terms of technology, making sure those technologies that we have the chance to build are built here. And other governments around the world, you know, encourage development in certain areas to great benefit. I mean, in energy alone should be a national emergency here. I mean, we were talking last hour about the sad story that villagers with 40% unemployment in rural Alaska are in a situation where they're going to accept assistance from Venezuela, a guy that, you know, finds Americans and our government highly objectionable, is going to pay for the fuel oil to heat their homes this winter because our government can't figure it out with record-breaking prices for oil and gas around the country. And it's not just Alaskans. Every fixed-income person, right now we're in the lull. You know, the reason oil prices are dropping is this is the bumper season when we're not running as much air conditioning. We're not running the big heaters yet. And so the price is dropping. It's normal. This time of year, look at it historically, it's always happened. When the elections are over and winter is pressing on, who is going to address this problem? And, this, you know, here we are spending billions, almost a half a trillion, to reconstruct countries that attacked us or harbored those that did or in some way violated us, and we can't take care of the people that have built this country. And we have veterans benefits being cut around the country. The brain trauma centers budgets were cut. We got more brain trauma veterans than ever before. And we're not addressing these things. You know, people are called to fight in these wars, whether we like these wars or not. These are our men and women risking their lives, and we ought to be taking care of them when they come back. And we have seniors, retired veterans that still can't get the basic benefits they're entitled to, having fought in every conflict going back to World War II. And, you know, these are all things that Americans need to take stock of. We need to recognize the sacrifices that have already been made, and how to build a country back up so that we can do the kinds of things all of us would like to do around the world. But, you know, you got to do it from a strong base, and we've lost a lot of our base. Can't be everything to everyone, every place on the planet, unless we're a strong country at home, and that country has to be based on American values. The things that once upon a time gained us respect wherever Americans traveled, that respect is diminished, not because of who we are, not because of our character, but because of the poor reflection of that character in so much of our leadership around the country. You know, this is an exciting election year. Find those guys that are the mavericks, whether it's in local politics or your state politics or your national politics. If you are fortunate enough to have them, encourage them, get involved in their elections. You know, we're seeing amazing things happen around the country. You know, candidates that are being outspent 5, 6, 7, 10 to 1 in terms of spending by their opponents are pulling off primaries and getting into the picture. Let's see what we can do, you know, because little people, all of us who take real actions are what matters in political campaigns. And we're seeing that spread a little bit around the country as people ask for the kind of accountability that all of us are entitled to. And it doesn't matter Republican or Democrat, they're all guilty. They all have blood on their hands. They all have liberty on their hands. And we need to reconstruct it by getting back a little piece of our government. If you want to call in today, call in at 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. You know, over the last few months, as we've covered a lot of these areas in technology, and I've gotten a lot of feedback from folks, and people send me information all the time. I want to encourage you to do that. A lot of things don't make the AP wire. You know, around the country, people listen to these programs, run into news stories, and assume that we see them. We don't always see them. You can get hold of us through the network. We're easy enough to find on the website. It's got contact information for us. And all of the hosts, I think, on these programs really do rely on callers to keep us up on bits of information that flow in. You know, Marilyn calls in every once in a while, and I appreciate her comments in California because she's always well informed. And I think that's RBN listeners generally tend to be better informed on these issues because people are paying attention. And that's, you know, I think that's a big step in the right direction. But more than that, we need to actually act on some of this. You know, it may not be the issues we're covering today, but in every community, in every place where this broadcast is heard, there are issues that are important to you, issues that you can weigh in on and should weigh in on. And even, you know, don't look around for the group or the organization to form. It's already here. You're standing in it. In fact, that's all it really requires, is that each of us do a little something in furtherance of what we believe to be right and true, and then real government returns to us, and we're able to take a little piece of this thing back and maybe have a bigger impact on future outcomes. And things are going to get tough in the United States. I mean, when we look at the issues, not just in technology, but why is this such a predisposition by government to get greater and greater control over populations? Why is it that it's so important for governments to assert this kind of power? And I think it's clear, at least from my perspective, that the understanding of what's coming, I mean, the displacements of population based on climate change models. Forget about blaming man for it or nature for it. I personally believe it's a little of each and a lot of nature. And you know, the thing about all this is we are seeing huge changes. They're going to result in droughts, flooding, higher levels of storm damage than ever been seen before around the world. We've been saying this since the mid-90s, and we've been right, dead on right, every time we've said it, and it's escalated significantly over the years. If everything stopped today, it wouldn't reverse itself for 100 years, according to most climate models. The reality is it's going to breed a great deal of unrest. You're going to see continual unrest in Africa as drought conditions there worsen and intensify, even more so by the conditions themselves sort of feeding on themselves. Here in the Arctic, huge amounts of natural gas in the form of methane is being released from permafrost deposits across Canada, Siberia, Alaska, and northern portions of Europe. that actually is 20 times more potent than CO2 coming out of your exhaust of your automobiles. And what we're seeing is an acceleration of this. And what that is going to do in terms of food production is going to be highly disruptive around the world. That alone is going to change things dramatically. There's some things coming technologically that are on the horizons in terms of energy and energy sources that might dwarf whatever oil and fossil fuels have done. There is some really excellent research coming, and I believe in the next couple of years we're going to see major breakthroughs in energy that reduce the cost of energy significantly. But getting that technology into the hands of people is not going to be overnight. It's going to probably take a decade or two to make the full transition. And in the meantime, there is so much that's got to be done. We need to quit arguing about some of the causes and really address the underlying problem, which is what are we going to do as food production and growing regions change? And they are changing. Anyone involved in agriculture around the United States or anywhere in the world clearly understand this. Anyone close to the land understands this. And the reality about all that is it affects every one of us. Energy costs currently are driving all commodity prices up to astronomical levels. Energy is about a third of all of those costs. When you factor energy into the equation, energy should be a national emergency. There should be huge national prizes offered by governments to encourage real alternatives that provide additional energy sources that are more economic and more efficient and cleaner than the ones that we have now. And we could do it, and we're not doing anything. You know, Brazil did this, and I've said it before, after the last oil embargo of the early 70s, and they are energy independent, the biggest country in Latin America, energy independent by national initiatives to make sure it happened. We need those initiatives in the United States now more than ever. What's driving too much of our foreign policy are, in fact, energy issues. And let's not forget that this administration, in their first 4 years, in their first 2 years, had major discussions on energy policy with energy executives from all over the country. And those discussions and meeting notes remain undisclosed. They remain held by the White House, unavailable to the public. And yet, whatever policies they discussed 6 years ago, we certainly see the results of it today. And they aren't the results most Americans would like, which is probably why none of those notes are available to any of us to look at right now. And this is, again, you know, when do we break down these barriers? You know, if they call national security issues or should be the only real legitimate issues, and now national security issues seem to extend to the Savior Bacon philosophy of political leadership. And it's not about national security, it's their personal political security, and somehow they've mixed that up. You know, individuals are still individuals, whether they sit in the president's desk or sit at the gas station pumping gas. Whatever we do doesn't diminish or extend who we are as participants in this democratic republic. And this elitism that has emerged from government and corporate and academic America is not what this was all about. It was quite the opposite. And that's where we are missing those opportunities to take and utilize what we have as a government, as a form of government, to propel the 21st century on a platform of values, not on a platform of greed, a platform based on Wall Street and not Main Street. And that has happened for way too long. We need a strong sense of who we are as a country again. We need to be able to rebuild this country from the inside out and from the leadership down, and then turn it back around so the leadership is at the bottom, supporting this population as leaders should, and not sitting on the top as some great pyramid pressing its weight down upon the average citizen. Those days need to end. We need to go back to the democracy's untold story, I guess, in the modern vein. We got to go back to what we understood as a democratic republic, a place where we could debate. We could enjoy that privilege and opportunity of debate that lent itself to the kind of public policy that got the United States recognized around the world. You know, we've rebuilt Europe, we've rebuilt Asia, we've rebuilt economies all over the world, and it's time to rebuild our own. And it is time. I think most RBN listeners are of the same mind. You know, there's an opportunity to really do some good things, but we need to put attention towards those things that can really change the world, not just through militaries, but through a rightfully applied technology. And I think that's the challenge again. In the 21st century. This is the RBN Republic Broadcasting Network, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. Give us a call at 800-313-9443, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we're into the last segment before we have to go for the day, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. I want to mention my websites again for research that feeds this program, that provides us the data that we use in presenting our information. Take a look at the Lay Institute, layinstitute.org. And then for information on our books and publications, take a look at earthpulse.com, E-A-R-T-H-P-U-L-S-E, earthpulse.com. You know, today we've covered a lot of subjects, all drawn right out of the mainstream media. You know, and the thing that it doesn't do, mainstream doesn't do, is tie those stories together. So they start to weave a carpet so we can see what exactly these things do in terms of impacting all of us. We try to do that with this program, bringing you the latest in technology and their impacts, as well as sort of a political perspective on how these things actually play out. We appreciate RBN providing us the opportunity to do this, and we're going to continue to hopefully bring you the kind of programming we've brought you over the last few months. You know, when we look at technology, and again, today's issues, it's really an opportunity to make some changes. You know, technology will either serve us or enslave us. Today, the technologies we have are the most fantastic. I mean, 100 years ago, definitely they would have been considered science fiction. I mean, think back, if you brought somebody from 500 years ago to today and just walking into your house and seeing lights and listening to radio and looking at a television set, would all be considered miraculous. The same can be said about the technologies that we'll see in the 21st century. They're saying technology is doubling every 9 to 10 months from the invention of the wheel to where we are at the moment. And as that technology doubles, our need to have translators to be able to sort through that barrage of data and try and pick out those things that definitely are going to have major major impacts on what we see in the world and how it comes. Our worldviews do matter. How we see ourselves does matter. Changing the way we view the world, the way we see the world, the name of this program is about looking at that information, determining what we need to do, and then hopefully encouraging listeners to take an action, step into the issues you believe in, the things that you believe are right and true, act on those. That is indeed the step of faith, that thing unseen. When you step into what you believe in right is right and true and act on it in a responsible way, that's when you act on the faith that you're given inside. That's when all things are possible. And with this program, we hope to be able to encourage people not to succumb to fear, but to recognize who we are as created individuals, capable of not just controlling our own lives with individual liberty and sovereignty, but actually impacting the lives of others in a positive way by trying to help each other and ourselves reach our highest and best potentials. That's the challenge of the 21st century. The technologies that we have available to us can build on that challenge. Next week, I want to talk about some of those technologies that are being used for enhancing human performance, solving some of the big problems, whether it be stroke recovery, attention deficit disorders with children. We're going to cover some of the technologies that are here now that address those problems, as well as reaching more capable and competent states in terms of intellectual potential, increasing net brain potential, if you will. We're going to talk next week about some of those technologies that allow both left and right brain, creative and intellectual, to work together at much higher levels, much more efficiently. Technologies of the 21st century, changing the way we see the world. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back next week, next Wednesday, 11 a.m. Until 1 p.m. Central Time. This is Dr. Nick Begich, signing off with the Republic Broadcasting Network.